Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, it's been in the 90s here in D.C. all week, and I know you requested a rosé for this episode, and I went and I looked and I couldn't match it. So I went beer again, because it's so easy to match beer.
And a cold beer on a summer night's okay, too. So it's from the Key Brewing Company, and it's called Speed Wobbles. Just the shimmy, not the shake. And it features some woman standing on a skateboard looking like she's possibly going to wobble off.
But just the shimmy.
Just the shimmy.
It's a session IPA. Key Brewing Company is from Dundalk. Dundalk, Maryland.
On the water there.
What are you thinking?
I'm thinking it's a perfectly pleasant standard IPA, right?
Well, it's less hardcore than last week's. Last week's, remember, was a 7.8%. This is a pleasant 4.6.
Yeah, I was feeling last week's very quickly, and so this one is quite nice.
What did I match it to?
I think you could only have matched anything with speed in the name to Fast and Furious presents
:
Hobbs and Shaw.
Fast and Furious : Hobbs and Shaw. It's not Fast and Furious 9. Yes, it is a spinoff. There's been, I can't even follow the drama that there was all this drama between Vin Diesel and Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and they're best friends and they hate each other. Anyways, The Rock and Jason Statham got a spinoff. I had found that the most recent series of Fast Furious films, Fast 5, 6, 7, and Fate of the Furious, were getting, I mean, they were ridiculous, and each one was getting more ridiculous, but I still found them entertaining. And in fact, the first four are actually quite dry compared to the second four. So I appreciate the back half of the series, even after the tragic disappearance of Paul Walker.
That's good to know, because I don't think I saw 1 through 5. I think I actually started picking up the series somewhere around 2011 with Fast 5. So I don't feel any need whatsoever to go back and see the first four. But I remember being pleasantly entertained by the Fast and Furious franchise from the moment that I picked it up. It's been around for like 19 years now.
The Hobbs and Shaw spinoff takes its tone, takes its atmosphere and its feeling from the back half. It's ridiculous. it's corny. It's supposed to be cheesy. It's supposed to feel,
it's over the top.
Come on. You're supposed to go, oh, that would never happen. And actually, in the first four films, you wouldn't say that. Actually, they tried to stay, this is street racing. This is real street racing with Vin Diesel going, this is the family. Now it's just camp. And it's welcome camp. It's funny. I don't love it, but it's okay, just because it's so predictable. I'll set you up with the setup, and then you can take it away. In the beginning, it starts with a song on the Universal logo you wouldn't expect to hear. Time in a Bottle.
If I could save time in a bottle.
Wow, we didn't even plan that just happened. The MacGuffin happens, somebody does something, and they have limited time to figure it out and actually take it out of their body. They have limited time, and technically it's in a bottle. And then we get cut to split screen. We got The Rock on the left. He's getting out of bed, lifting weights, getting in his truck. We got Jason Statham on the right. It's raining, it's London, he's got a sleek sports car, there's a chick in the bed, and he makes the world's perfect omelet.
And he looks really good in a very form-fitting Italian suit.
So you have this very overt montage of, they're so different, but they're so similar. And then it gets into the family tree game. The Rock is explaining to his daughter, who says, I have this family tree thing at school, Daddy. How come, you know, here's our family tree. How come there's nobody on it? It's just you and me. Oh, something happened in Samoa. I wonder if that'll come back. Then you have Jason Statham visiting mom, Helen Mirren, in jail, and all she can say is, call your sister, call your sister. I wonder if that'll come back. Hannah, what do you think about this? They're so different, they're the same, and they both happen to have family tree issues on the same day.
Yeah, I mean, what this whole entire spinoff is about is setting up a new team. So you have these two guys with giant egos who both, you know, they don't like each other. There's bad blood. There's history between them. So there's a reason that it's not like this bromance going on. But you know right off the bat that this movie is going to be ultimately about family and healing relationships. And so that, you know, but then you've got this whole giant action, crazy adventure thing going on at the same time that makes this movie just all-encompassing, a fun ride that you just kind of have to go with. And you've got Idris Elba showing up as the quote-unquote villain. I mean, he even introduces himself as, I'm the bad guy.
He does say
that. Lest you think you don't know what his role in this film is going to be. But that's kind of what you're in for. And the what makes this movie worth watching is it's the banter. It's the barbs that Hobbs and Shaw exchange. But then there is a third player in the mix of the team that's being set up by this spinoff, Hobbs and Shaw, and that is the sister. He called his sister, but she was in the midst of having some issues. She's got some things going on because she's this MI6 agent whose entire team has just been obliterated, and she snags this super virus that the bad guys are after, and then they're after her in addition to the virus. And so enter your long-lost brother, your estranged brother, and one of his enemies who now has to be one of your friends. And, you know, that's then the entire plot, such as it is, unfolds from there as these three people are sort of put together to try and save the world and save their relationships. But the sister, Hattie, is played by Vanessa Kirby, and she was in, I think, Mission Impossible, and she's kick-ass. She was really... she's really holding her own with these two guys. So even though the primary reason you're watching is to see these guys sort of facing off and having their fun trying to work together, I see the Hattie character, Shaw's sister, also being part of a team as this particular spinoff franchise moves forward.
There is a science fiction undercurrent, maybe even overcurrent, in the film. Idris Elba is spouting philosophy about human evolution is too slow, today's humans aren't going to cut it, we need augmented biology, we need to, the cutting edge technology, the wave of the future is get rid of the weak, hence the virus, and we are going to make superhumans. That really goes nowhere. It's really kind of just his spooky motivation to go out and do what he does. There's a very strange situation of dark money, owning the media, augmented humanity.
Yeah, none of that matters. It just doesn't. This is literally the entire movie can be just really boiled down to you've got a fight scene, a car chase, a couple of exchange barbs and banter. And then it happens again and again and again until the movie ends and you've got the family and healing theme coming back at the end. It all wraps up and you've got a couple of elements that you want to stick around for that go through the end credits. Literally, the film kind of continues while the end credits start to roll. So unlike some people, Charlie, you don't want to leave while the credits are still rolling.
But what if you have a friend you know is going to stay there and you're like the first out of the parking lot?
Well, and I did make the mistake. I was almost as bad as you because I stayed through what I thought might be the end of the bonus scenes, but it was not. Apparently, there was even yet an additional bonus scene at the very, very, very end that I too missed. So just warning folks out there that some of the loose ends are really kind of wrapped up a little bit while the end credits are starting to roll. And so you don't want to miss those. They're kind of clever and cute and just kind of are meant to sort of lead you into what is sure to be the next Hobbs and Shaw. But also, it's worth noting, still in production, we are expecting Fast and Furious 9 and Fast and Furious 10 over the next year and a half, 2 years. So we are, we have not seen the last of any of this Fast and Furious universe, these characters, whether there will eventually be a Fast and Furious movie that has some healing going on between Vin Diesel and The Rock remains to be seen. But I can actually see them leveraging the whole possibility of this, of the infighting between the Fast and Furious and the Hobbs and Shaw people, and sort of using that as some major crossover event.
Yeah, they'll make a joke about it in there. There's a couple of jokes in here that about The Rock's eyebrow from real life. And this is directed by David Leitch. He was a stuntman, stunt coordinator to earn his stripes, and he directed Deadpool 2 and Atomic Blonde. Very profound. Well, Atomic Blonde is a very violent, profound action film. Deadpool 2 is more the comedy action, more of the, it's actually closer to the Hobbs and Shaw action, the unbelievable action. So he's quite good at that.
And he was involved in John Wick. So.
He was. He was a kind of a co-director, an uncredited co-director of the first John Wick before he split off from his partner there.
Yeah, the biggest difference is those are all R-rated films, and this is PG-13. And so while there's crazy action slash violence going on, it's relatively bloodless compared to most of the other films that he's directed. But that sensibility of how these things are directed and their tone, that's still very much there. But it's just a family-friendlier kind of action movie. And it's, you know, it's fleeting in its memorability in the scheme of things, but absolutely just a summer escapist movie. It's available in IMAX. I don't really think, unless you're just like, I need bigger, I need to see this on an even bigger and bigger screen, any large screen will suffice. There's no definitive reason, I don't think, to see it in IMAX.
Yeah, it's light as a feather. It'll, you know, if that's your, if this is your genre, you'll be just fine. But to rack and stack, this is between the two. You know, it's not as good as 5, 6, 7, or 8. It's not, but it is better than Tokyo Drift. If you're if you know your Fast and Furious history, you know what I mean. It's better than Tokyo Drift.
Well, but it pays homage to its lineage with the Fast and Furious franchise, but has to do that something else of setting up this spinoff series. And so that's always a fine line. It's always a little trickier, but it's establishing this new dynamic. And that's why I think it might not be as good to folks that have watched a lot of the Fast and Furious films, where you really were getting into, by 5, 6, 7, you're really getting into the character development, and the loss of Paul Walker was something that you really kind of felt. And so this is like that, you know, that first entry into a new part of that universe. And so I can see how they can build on that to hopefully come up with something just as good, if not better, the next time around.
All right, now it's time for the documentary portion of our episode. The first one is called Mike Wallace is Here. 60 Minutes has been the most successful television program in the history, the short or long history, however you view it, history of television. 60 Minutes is A number one, still on the air. And from season one, episode one, even into the 2000s, the main lead anchor of a rotating cast, but some pretty heavy hitters, was Mike Wallace. He was there from the beginning and probably the longest tenured of them all. Well, Leslie Stahl might give him a run for his money. But it's somewhat a linear life and times of Mike Wallace, but it really delves into who was this man and what was his impact, either altruistic or shady, on the realm of investigative journalism. And it is actually quite tense. It's actually quite suspenseful. It's more suspenseful than anything in Hobbs and Shaw. Because there's this music, this just synth keyboard staccato, really propelling you forward, going, oh my God, what's going to come next? And I can't believe that happened. I did not, there's a lot. I did not know about Mike Wallace. I knew him from 60 Minutes. He's always that old guy. And he, you know,
and he was that intimidating one, the ambush guy. So the reason you've got Mike Wallace is here is that that's what people were known. It was like, it was usually like, uh-oh, Mike Wallace is here.
Apparently, that's not how he started. He was pitching Parliament cigarettes and Revlon and something called Fluffo. He was an actor. He was a B-list actor. Man. But he was also the first confrontational interview, you know, mano y mano, cigarette smoke billowing thing, and the sweating interviewee, and the how dare you dodge my question with a, it was even before 60 Minutes, called Night Beat. Never heard of it. Never heard of it. But apparently, Bill O'Reilly says, you know, Mike, if not for you, there would be no me. And the way he says it, it actually doesn't come off as 100% a compliment. So I learned, yes, you will learn a lot about Mike Wallace, A Death of a Child, multiple marriages, depression, stuff that you don't get from if you only know him as a TV personality who's welcome into your homes on Sunday evening after football. I really appreciated this documentary, not only because I learned, because it is so well made and put together and researched and paced and edited. Avi Belkin, the director,
Avi,
got it right. He crafted a fine documentary.
I saw him. He did a Q&A at the AFI Docs. I saw this film about a month and a half ago. It was part of a profile series of films that AFI Docs was putting on. And so because I have a degree in journalism, I was certainly interested in seeing this and know some folks who still work on 60 Minutes today. I did not know Mike Wallace's pre-60 Minutes history. It was rather fascinating to just grasp that he was, you know, he really had this acting thing going on. And so it makes you look a little bit differently at his interview style, and it made me kind of question, all right, so how much of this was sort of playing a role in, you know, as opposed to, you know, the real hard-hitting journalism for the sake of investigative reporting. And, you know, it did sort of influence how I viewed his impact on current, on the talking heads of today and on more confrontational journalism. There's good and bad in that. So Avi in the Q&A really talked about how he didn't start out doing a documentary about Mike Wallace. He was really initially looking at the state of journalism today and the roots of confrontational journalism. But what happened was he ended up getting 60 Minutes opened up their entire archives to him. And so this film is constructed very differently than a standard documentary, which there are good things and bad things about it. There are no new talking heads. There are no new interviews. It is all based on archival footage, on things that he was able to pull from outtakes, everything that just existed in the 60 Minutes archive. And so there were times where I almost wanted some new perspective on something, a new interview, but that was not where this director wanted to go. He was staying strictly with having gone through thousands of hours of outtakes and footage and raw interviews and interviews that made it on air, and using all of that to then reveal more about Mike Wallace and that those other sides to him, his personal life, but it doesn't go all that far into. It leaves you wondering. Okay, so sort of glosses over his five marriages and you don't see anything with other than one quick shot really involving his son Chris Wallace, and so you kind of want to know, like, well, you know, exactly what did Chris Wallace learn from his dad's style. There's no opportunity presented in this film to really explore any of that. It is truly a exploration of Mike Wallace's trajectory, and it was fascinating to learn the pre-60 Minutes stuff. That to me was completely unknown and really fascinating. And this is just a really interesting film, especially for news junkies and folks who just sort of really kind of miss what Mike Wallace brought to the table and the fear he generated when he did show up at somebody's door for an interview.
I do not think he needed new interviews. So he shows all the interviews that made Mike Wallace famous. There's Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Barbara Streisand, Vladimir Putin, Ayatollah Khomeini. It's got him and Larry King interviewing one another and dissecting each other's style. Larry, you're a pushover. You're a softie. I go in and I get him. I said, hey, what? Why are you a crook? What is the crime? And Larry, you nibble around the edges. And, you know, he asks Larry, how many times have you been married? Why do you have problems with women? And Larry throws it back at him. Well, how many times have you got married? And Mike, you know, says, well, what does that have to do with anything? All of a sudden, ooh, the interviewer does not like the tables being turned. He cannot take what he is dishing out. That also comes up when he is sued. CBS, 60 Minutes, and Mike Wallace are sued by General Westmoreland, the lead general who ran the Vietnam War. And he's suing them for libel for an interview that's coming up saying, you're lying about me. And what came out of that is Mike Wallace's questions, most of his questions, were written by producers. Therefore, how pure of an investigative journalist is Mike Wallace, and how much is this actually show business? How much is he a talking head?
Right.
And what about responsibility? There he is running to, he's going to be the guy to interview Ayatollah Khomeini. And he says, not my words. I didn't say this, but did you hear what Anwar Sadat said about you? And next month, Anwar Sadat is assassinated.
Yeah, no, his showmanship is certainly exposed in a very different sort of way in this. And I, you know, having come from that world, I'm fully aware that producers do the bulk of the heavy lifting when it comes to prepping interviews and doing a lot of the investigative research. It's not unusual for the on-air talent to really just kind of show up and put a face on the script. So that part did not really surprise me all that much. But it does show, okay, who's ultimately responsible for the words that come out of somebody's mouth and are projected on air. That's why I think it's sort of it pulls back the curtain on certain things in an interesting way. It's interesting in how it deals with his history of depression. So it's one of those things that can actually be a very useful conversational tool. But you also feel a little cheated that he kind of lied about it. You see that he sort of lied about how bad it was and denied certain things for several years. And then you see one of his later interviews where he's interviewed by one of his colleagues where he kind of fesses up to the fact that that he really had not been very forthcoming and truthful about his battles with depression. So in his, you know, in his later years, he really was. But it just sort of makes you go, oh my gosh, you know, you never quite know until everything can sort of be reexamined in hindsight, really just how much truth is coming out. And for me to even understand and to realize just what a history he had in acting and pitching things, it did really sort of change my filter a little bit for thinking about what exactly he was doing, how his interview style was coming off, and whether or not sort of in the same, you know, just what he knew he was doing and knew exactly why and what kind of reactions he'd be getting and was sort of playing into what could in some ways be conceived of as as almost a screenplay rather than investigative journalism.
Having access to all of 60 Minutes archives, I think, would be overwhelming, which is why just kudos to Avi Belkin for being able to parse and be able to tell a story from such an overwhelming amount of source material. You mentioned being interviewed by his peers, and I love the 60 Minutes interviews. Leslie Stahl, Steve Croft, Ed Bradley all interview him, but the best one is Morley Safer, and he comes right out and says, Mike, why are you, you know, when's the last time we have lunch? You're right, we've never had lunch. Why are you such a prick?
Yeah.
And Mike's like, yeah, fair question.
Yeah,
touche.
Yeah, yeah.
Which really makes Mike Wallace's here, I think, one of the year's strongest documentaries so far because of the ocean of material out there. He was able to craft this very succinct story that works.
It didn't all work for me as well as it worked for you, but I do understand you have to make tough calls, tough choices when you have so much raw material to work with. And so, yes, I do think the director made the film that he really wanted to make, and that's not always easy to do, and actually was able to deliver something fresh and new that even with old material, you learn something new, and that's quite a feat.
Well, moving on to our next documentary. I have already seen David Crosby in a documentary this year. It was called Echo in the Canyon. And in fact, I'm pretty sure I've seen David Crosby in seven other documentaries throughout the year. He's in everything. I know he was there and part of it all, but he's still here. And he's still part of it all, especially on the lookbacks and the nostalgia pieces. But I did not see David Crosby Remember My Name. But well, we don't have to remember his name because he's still alive in every documentary.
And he's, I think, one of the reasons that they call it that is that he's as surprised as anybody at the fact that he's still alive. Because by, you know, when you see what his life has involved and what happened to most of the people that he hung out with that were doing the same kinds of things that he was doing, they did not survive that whole era. And so he really pushed the limits and is just not necessarily one that you would expect to have survived. But he is still ticking and he's still performing. And, you know, I think he was one of the ones slated to perform in the now canceled Woodstock 50 concert that imploded. But he, you know, he shows in this documentary, he really narrates the whole thing. And that there's a big difference from something like Mike Wallace is here, where you don't have Mike Wallace around to really tell his story the way he might want to tell it. David Crosby is telling his story really the way he feels it can and should be told in his own words. And that's what makes this documentary certainly different and interesting for anyone who may have been a fan of The Birds or a fan of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Crosby, Stills & Nash, and wondered, well, what exactly, why was he in all these different bands and what happened to them? Well, you say Mike Wallace talked about how he was a prick at some point. David Crosby basically says the same thing and acknowledges, yeah, I screwed up. I probably was not the best bandmate out there, and I kind of messed up a couple of good things, but I was devoted and dedicated to doing things my way, the kind of music I wanted to do, when I wanted to do it, and who I wanted to do it with, and in doing so, he alienated his you know, brothers in the band.
Yeah, when I know this was at AFI Docs and it was a Saturday night piece, because they always put the music documentary on Saturday night, and it's perfect. A rule of thumb out there is if there's a music documentary at the film festival you're at, go see it. It just, you know, it'll lighten the mood, it'll boost your morale, and I skipped it this year. I was tired. I wanted to go home.
Well, there was a whole series of them this year, though, so it was really hard, because there was one on Miles Davis, there was the one on David Crosby, there was one on, a really good one on Linda Ronstadt. They just kept going and going and going, and so there were like five or six different really good
This one had the key slot, though.
Yeah, but I ended up missing this one at AFI Docs and catching up on it later. But it was, you know, to me, it's sort of not better than, it's on par with some of those other ones.
Well,
that
compared
we've been
to
seeing.
The one we saw this year already with him in it, compared to the not very good Echo in the Canyon.
I liked Echo in the Canyon, and because to me that was about this entire culture and community in California and that whole, you know, just the whole genre of music and its growth. And so all these films, to me, just kind of have pieces that complement each other. And so you just kind of learn a little bit more as you watch another one about that time and about the obvious consistent factor is that they were all doing lots of drugs and they were all kind of crashing at each other's houses and making music in the backyard and having the time of their lives and really just appreciating, you know, what they were creating. And then, you know, some at a certain point, everything just kind of grinds to a halt because you can't survive in that mode of being constantly on drugs. David Crosby spent time in jail. I mean, you really do learn a lot more about where he's been And that makes it even more shocking when you realize that that he somehow managed to come through it, but he's got a lot of health issues. And so it's just always ironic when you lose a lot of these musicians and you go, you know, that's just so shocking. With him, if he were suddenly, he even acknowledges that he expects to just sort of die on the road someday. And his wife is sort of okay with him just kind of leaving and going and doing his thing, knowing that she may never see him again. It's, you know, you kind of go, more power to you. He sort of has this second, third, or fourth lease on life that he's trying to take advantage of. And music is obviously the most important thing to him, always has been, always will be. And you kind of gain a bit of a new appreciation for that. But I love the music of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, the harmonies. And so to me, I'm not sure that that I'd be all that keen on going out and listening to just David Crosby sing. But it's just a good little, another piece of a giant puzzle about the history of folk rock music.
Well, looking ahead to next week, the past couple weeks have been a dribble of films. Kind of, you've got the one tent pole, and then not very much. Next week is making up for that. It is turning the spigot back on.
It's crazy.
It's opening the faucet wide open. If you go by theater count, then the biggest films next week are For the Kids, Dora, and The Lost City of Gold, which I'm taking my six-year-old to tomorrow morning, and Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which we are both actually going to skip.
Mm-hmm.
Coming after that is one we saw last night, based off of the book, The Art of Racing in the Rain. And we're also going to catch up with Mobster Women in the Kitchen. And then there's even another four or five art house films where you really have to rack and stack. I can't believe they're all coming out on the same weekend.
It's ridiculous, because I was looking through and going, well, do I want to see that? This is sort of interest to me, or I kind of heard about that one. So right now I'm leaning towards, if I actually get the link sent to me, this one called Brian Banks that's based, I like movies that are based on true stories. And this one is based on the true story of some star high school athlete who was wrongly convicted of a crime. And then the Innocent Project helps him get released, and he's able to pursue his dream of an NFL career. So it's got a whole bunch of those elements, the sports drama and the crime and innocence and stuff that I tend to like. So I'm kind of interested in that one. And then I think hopefully, maybe, perhaps both, we're going to check out Tel Aviv on Fire.
Yeah, we ended up watching, you know, a few films in Hebrew every year, and they actually always turn out to be okay to awesome.
Yeah, well, and usually they're quirky dramas, but this one looks like a quirky comedy, but it's about a guy who worked on a Palestinian soap opera in 1969, and it's right up just in the months leading up to the Six-Day War. So it's a comedy about the divide between Israelis and Palestinians in 1967. And so it probably has elements that have can be considered timely today, and also sort of historical in its reflections. But yeah, I'm kind of looking forward to that one, because it just looks different.
You know, speaking of different, since life is about time management, one I would like to see, but I'm not going to see, is, it's called Them That Follow, and it's about a church that practices the art and science of incorporating snakes in their services.
Yeah, I figured out.
Man, that is right up my alley.
I thought that one had you written all over it.
But Rack and Stack, there's probably four others I want to see, and I still really want to see that.
There's one I call Piranha. Yeah, and there's
one that's Italian neorealism.
Yeah,
one I think
another
also
one that's
be overall,
also you.
But there's just so
there's
much.
An Octavia Spencer movie, Loose.
Yeah, it was Loose. A Sundance hit.
Yeah, so it's really tough. So I think what often happens at this sort of stage is that you kind of go, well, there's just too much to choose from, and the best will eventually float to the top come award season, and we'll figure out what at that point if there's something that we absolutely need to catch up on. But for the most part, I think we're just going to have to pick our poison.
Well, for a Well, my poison would be snakes in church. But to recap a week that didn't have as much opportunity, Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Shaw. It's light. There's a lot of action, but not violent action. It's that funny, cheesy action. It's okay.
Coming on the heels of a film like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood that makes you sort of contemplate and think and dissect, this is one that's strictly a guilty pleasure popcorn movie. And so skip. It's one of those, I'm going to skip my vegetables and go straight to dessert or have my big tub of popcorn movies.
Now, if you say skip your vegetables, you're talking about skipping Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which would be a sin. But actually, the more you think about this movie, the worse it is.
Eat your vegetables and then go get your
dessert. So don't think
dessert.
About it. It will get worse. Mike Wallace is here. It's in my top five documentaries of the year. Not only because I learned a lot, it's just because it's so darn well made.
I've been seeing so many documentaries that it'll be really hard come the end of the year to sort of remember what I liked the most. But I enjoyed Mike Wallace is Here, and the fact that 60 Minutes is still a venerable institution of really good television. It's great to kind of give a little bit of homage to Mike Wallace.
And David Crosby.
David Crosby, it made me just want to go out and find my old Crosby, Stills, and Nash album, which I think Southern Cross was my favorite song from that album. So that's what that film did for me, is it just reminded me of that one small period of time where I actually knew who David Crosby was and what he was a part of and liked that particular music.
All right. Well, that's it, folks. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.